Welcome to the Ithaca Radio Hour for the week of May 31st. I'm your host, Sylvie Ginnenthal. Tonight we have a story about the 17-year cicadas that are emerging right now across the eastern seaboard. We go for a ride in a vegetable oil-powered car, and our first story is about the sister community partnership between Central New Yorkers and farmers in Southern Columbia. Dana Brown and Linda Farthing bring us this story.
Some days it is easy to believe that the only things that have been truly globalized in our world are fear, terrorism, and the international flow of money. But here in Central New York, communication, hope, and solidarity are being globalized through a sister city project with the Movimiento Campesino de Cajibillo, an organization representing small farmers in southern Colombia. These farmers live in one of the areas most affected by the Colombian conflict, but they have banded together to find solutions to their problems, which don't involve siding with any of the armed actors in the conflict, the army, right-wing paramilitaries, or left-wing guerrillas. And people in Syracuse, Cortland, and Ithaca have agreed to help them. Megan Sheehan, coordinator of the Committee on U.S.-Latin American Relations at Cornell, is one of those involved.
I was immediately attracted to the idea of international solidarity in the form of a sister community, because it provides us with an alternative to the traditional forms of aid provided to Colombia by the United States. Instead of perpetuating the violence of a 50-year-long civil war, the Cajibillo Sister Community Partnership provides us with an opportunity to work towards grassroots development and international exchange on a person-to-person basis. And this helps us to work towards the larger goal of globalizing hope.
Megan and others in the group see the Sister Community Project as an alternative form of aid to Colombia that counters the massive military aid provided by the U.S. government. Since 2000, the U.S. has spent a staggering $3.7 billion in Colombia, most of it for military or police forces, with the goal of stopping the flow of drugs northward. Mary Roldan, a Cornell history professor who comes from Medellin, a city in south-central Colombia, explains what this has done.
I feel that some of the really long-lasting negative effects are that people are becoming increasingly unwilling to speak up. It's terrifying because the military is now more present. And so what you're seeing is an extraordinary rise in the sense not only of insecurity, but of people's terror at speaking out, of being lumped with anyone. So no one's willing to voice an opinion, because if you say that you support the military, the guerrillas will come after you. If you give a chicken to the guerrillas when they come by, or which people do all the time because I don't really have a choice, then the paramilitaries come after you. If you don't have any information to give to the Colombian military, then they accuse you of being a collaborator or a supporter of one of the leftist groups. And it's created a sense of extraordinary tension and a real humanitarian emergency in select areas within Colombia. I don't want to give the impression that this is true throughout Colombia. The fact of the matter is that the areas that have experienced the most intensive and concentrated and systematic effects of violence are relatively few, and they tend to be located in these areas that are geographically isolated with very valuable commodities, and they're areas where historically the state has had almost no presence, for good or for ill.
However, Mary explained, Plan Colombia itself isn't the only problem the Colombian people face.
Plan Colombia has had a tremendous impact, but the ills that affect Colombia are not solely the result of Plan Colombia. In fact, what Plan Colombia has done is to magnify and reinforce and make much more systematic problems that were already present there. So one of the things that Plan Colombia does is, first, it transforms it into an exclusively military conflict. It's one in which if you can possibly increase the amount of force, then the internal conflict itself will be resolved. And it leaves aside entirely questions of social and economic development, which of course are critical to these regions, because the areas that are most severely affected by violence in Colombia, not only today but have been for the last 40 to 50 years, are areas that are characterized by a set of commonalities. First of all, most of them were sparsely populated areas of relatively recent colonization with very valuable resources that are typically difficult to get access to except by air.
And that's certainly true for the southern area of Colombia, where what you have are airstrips that were developed primarily by narcotics traffickers for shipping coca and heroin in and out. And before that, there weren't any major roads that actually connected it to the country's infrastructure. One of the elements that militarizing the conflict has produced is to ignore some of those issues, like the absence of infrastructure, the absence of any kind of alternative economic development, the fact that these people can't grow corn and tomatoes and subsistence agriculture and hope to live from that because there aren't any markets. And there's no place to get it to market. And those commodities aren't valuable enough to justify shipping them out by airplane, the way it is possible to ship things out like coca and heroin.
Marilyn Serna Salinas, a member of the Cajibio movement, comes from one such community. In her visit to central New York, Marilyn described the effects of Plan Colombia in her community. In addition to increased militarization of the region, Marilyn stated that Plan Colombia has vastly increased the aerial fumigation of coca crops, putting local people and their subsistence crops in danger of contamination. She also said that the social programs under Plan Colombia are nothing more than handouts, which create dependency. Her community has decided not to accept government funds and has created their own proposal for development, which they call the Plan for Life. For this plan to be successful, Marilyn came to New York to strengthen international ties and build solidarity.
Nosotros estamos hoy aquí porque pensamos
we are here because we think it is necessary to protect the social fabric that we have constructed over many years and which has allowed us to confront the violence. But this social fabric is so vulnerable that it needs international solidarity to care for it, to help it, so that we can create a better society. Our proposal, first and foremost, is that there is a political solution to the conflict and that there is not a military solution. We propose that negotiations must take place that incorporate the proposals of the population on how to construct a new system.
Marilyn also let us know how we could help the people of Colombia from here.
Queremos incidir también aquí en los Estados Unidos.
We want to make sure that people in the U.S. know what is going on in Colombia and that you communicate with your senators and representatives so that they don't continue investing in this war and that they don't spend millions of dollars on military solutions that in reality don't get us anywhere.
In solidarity with the small farmers movement of Cajibio, sister community organizers have been arranging educational talks in local schools and selling Seeds of Solidarity certificates, which support a revolving loan fund for small farmers in the region. The proceeds will be taken to Cajibio in August by several Central New Yorkers who plan to travel there. Megan is going on the delegation and is looking forward to seeing Marilyn again.
One of the things I remember most about Marilyn is her smile and her ability to work tirelessly for weeks on end. She's driven by her goals for a better world, but she's also driven by hope. And despite the horrors of the Colombian Civil War, which have often affected her personally, Marilyn's community has done some really amazing things. She knows that we can create a better world because she has seen it. She has a strong community that is dedicated to building a new life for themselves together. And theirs is a brave story that I think all of us can learn from.
For more information, or to help with the Cajibio Sister Community Project, please contact Kuslar at 607-255-7293 or Kuslar, that's CUSLAR, at cornell.edu.
That was Dana Brown, co-coordinator of Kuslar, with translation by Linda Farthing. Next, Jenny Whiteman brings us this interview with Joe Cummings about his decision to switch to a car powered by used vegetable oil.
Last year, I was working at Alternative Community School, and a former graduate had brought a car that he had converted himself to run on used vegetable oil. And what he did was he took a beer keg and he cut it in half. He installed a copper hose in it and ran all the wires through his car to make it run on vegetable oil. And he brought it to the Alternative Community School and he showed a bunch of classes. And immediately when I saw it, I knew I had to do this. I found a car. I bought a 2002 Volkswagen Golf. My neighbor, who runs Liquid Solar, installed the kit in February. And since then, I've been running on used vegetable oil.
Can we start up your car? Can I learn how it all works?
Sure. Follow me.
So right now, the car is running on diesel.
That's right. And you can smell the diesel. And after we get going, you'll smell the change. Take a good whiff of the diesel, because it smells like a bus.
So what kind of gas mileage do you get?
Well, a diesel engine gets 40 to 50 miles per gallon. So you get about the same with vegetable oil. I often drive to Toronto from here, and it's about 550 miles. And I can do that on less than 15 gallons of vegetable oil. You know, when I go to Vermont, it's a little over 600 miles, and then I just need one little 2-gallon container. But it's not necessary. If I ran out, I just switch to diesel, and I can finish the trip pretty easily.
And what about the combustion products that come out of the tailpipe?
They say it's 80% cleaner than a normal diesel engine. But the interesting part is that when you take fossil fuel out of the earth that's been buried there for billions and billions of years and release it into the atmosphere, you're adding carbon. When you use vegetable oil, the carbon was taken in from the atmosphere into the plant, and then you press the plant to make vegetable oil, and then you burn it in your car, and then the carbon goes back in the atmosphere, so it's considered a net zero.
Or a closed loop.
Right. So we're getting close to 190 here, so we're almost ready to start our trip.
Woohoo!
Here's the switch. You want to listen to it. Click over. We've now switched over to vegetable oil, and you can hear there's no real difference in the sounds the engine is making or anything. It's pretty seamless. And actually, it'll help if we start driving. Not sure. I hadn't thought about where we should go, but...
Fast.
You want to go fast? All right. Well, then we can go 13. So as you can see, there's no big deal about cruising speeds or passing or... You know, it just sounds like a normal car. Which is the whole point of the diesel engine, because Rudolf Diesel invented his engine in the early 1900s to run on peanut oil, is what he used at the World's Fair in 1911. And his feeling was that the developing countries could grow their own fuel and wouldn't have to rely on petroleum. And you can see now how far that's come.
Would you ever consider using brand new vegetable oil, or will you always use used vegetable oil?
Well, the beauty of used vegetable oil is that restaurants have to pay someone to cart it away and put it in a landfill. So they're happy to have me take it away. So, as long as it's free and I'm helping out a local restaurant by saving them some money, I think it's a great, great system. Liquid Solar sells vegetable oil for $1 a gallon. So he'll come to your house and fill you up if you don't feel like filtering yourself. But again, he's buying used too. There's plenty of used. I mean, think about it. Every restaurant in town that has a fryer, every fast food restaurant. Just imagine how much used vegetable oil is brought to the landfill. I mean, there's an enormous amount. And I just read somewhere somebody paid like 70 cents a gallon for a barrel of vegetable oil. So still, oh look. I haven't looked at gasoline. $2.17 for the cheapest and $2.35 for the most expensive. Well, the other beauty is that diesel oil hasn't been increasing in price. Diesel fuel is still at 172, around there. So both the fuels I use are inexpensive. When I started telling people about this, the first reaction I got was, well, what if we run out of used vegetable oil? And I was so puzzled by the immediate negative comments, given the fact that, well, there's not enough petroleum. There's not so much that there's not enough that we have to go to other countries to take it. So I really didn't understand that comment, but I get it repeatedly. Well, what are you going to do when they run out of used vegetable oil? And I say, well, we'll grow it. Because usually when there's demand for something, somebody takes advantage of that demand. So farmers can grow it. Currently, farmers are paid to not grow crops, or paid to just throw milk down the drain or whatever. So there's certainly plenty of land and plenty of people that I'm sure would love to grow their own fuel. So I spoke to a friend of mine about this, and he said the same thing happens to him when he tells people that his family's vegetarian, that immediately they say, well, you can't do that, you're not getting enough nutrients, or you're not getting enough protein. And they immediately, not only do they just say, well, that's nice, you know, it's not for me, but they actually attack him for being a vegetarian or for having a vegetarian family. And he felt that that was more or less about the threat of change, that change is very threatening to people. And like I said, for me this was a simple process, just go and buy a diesel car and buy the kit and I find someone to install it, and then I'm ready to go. It means I have to do a little work collecting the oil and storing it in my basement, but for free fuel, that's more than worth it for me. Gasoline now is subsidized by the government. That's why it's cheaper here than anywhere. But you go to Europe and gas is $5 a gallon, and that's why people drive small cars and people conserve. But the government could easily subsidize vegetable oil. It's just that the oil men wouldn't profit off it. And I guess vegetable men doesn't sound as cool as oil men. So that's probably why we didn't have this vegetable cars running during the 70s oil crisis. It's too many people make money on it. It's strange that it doesn't occur to people that they've been lied to about needing fossil fuel and that their cars need to run on gasoline. For me, that's amazing, because as you can see, we're cruising along and we're running on used vegetable oil. Vegetable oil that was used in the fryer at ABC Cafe. They finished it and they put it in a container, and now I'm burning it in my car. And we're doing just fine. I'm in a brand new car, having a great time. And driving for free. And polluting 80% less.
So what would you recommend people do if they become interested in this?
Well, you can go to greasecar.com and look at Justin's site, and you can email him, and he's been very helpful responding to me with all my questions and all my concerns and paranoia about what was going to happen to my car. And he's very good at answering questions. And there are loads of sites on the internet. Actually, the book that I made this popular was called From Your Fryer to the Fuel Tank, and that was written by a man in Australia who started getting the word out about alternative fuel vehicles, and he explains how to set up a vegetable oil car. And it's a great book, and it's actually available at the Alternatives Library on the Cornell campus, and it'll explain to you how this all works. And otherwise, there are loads of websites and listservs.
Well, this tape recording has just arrived at the editor's house on veggie oil.
You get a good whiff of it now.
That was Jenny Whiteman interviewing Joe Cummings. Finally tonight, Jenny Whiteman interviews Cornell Professor of Entomology Cole Gilbert about the declining population of cicadas in our region.
What brought you to be interested in cicadas?
Well, they're especially the periodical cicadas that emerge every 17 or 13 years are a spectacular natural event. To be able to go outside and hear and see hundreds of thousands of members of a single species in one area is a pretty remarkable thing.
So what are cicadas and what is brood 10?
Oh, cicadas are an insect that is related to aphids. They have sucking mouth parts that they stick into the vascular system of plants and suck juices from them, as aphids do. They spend the immature period, the nymphal period, underground, and this usually lasts several years. But in the case of the periodical ones, can last 12 or 16 years. Brood 10 describes one of the broods of these creatures that exist in eastern North America. There are probably on the order of 30 different populations of them spread from New York south through the Carolinas and, I guess, west to Kansas. Almost each summer in a different place in the eastern United States, one of these broods emerges. And brood 10, I think, has its biggest density along the mid-Atlantic states, but there's also a population in eastern Tennessee and another one in the Ohio area, and they all will emerge this summer.
And can you say anything about the interesting 13 or 17-year cycle?
It's a really interesting evolutionary adaptation to be able to dodge your predators that way, to avoid the above-ground predators, because none can really track that kind of cycle, to go without eating for 16 years and know that they'll feed big.
What is the effect cicadas have on the ecosystem?
There's been relatively few studies of the underground life of the cicada, so I don't know, and I'm not sure that it is known, how the nymphal stages affect the health of the plants. As adults, they feed a little, but more of the damage that they do has to do with ovipositing, that the females have a tube-shaped egg-laying device, an ovipositor, and they insert their eggs into the tips of branches, the fresh growth of branches of hard and softwood trees, and they make a number of slits and deposit eggs in there, and this can damage the trees. It causes a condition that we call flagging, where the tip of a branch is weakened in a wind, then it can be broken but still hangs from the tree, and the leaves turn brown. So in an area where there's a large cicada emergence with thousands of individuals per hectare, the trees on a hillside will all be tipped with brown. It doesn't kill the trees, but it may damage that year's growth if there's a really heavy emergence. Another way that they fit into the ecosystem is providing an extremely abundant but temporary food source for omnivorous animals. Many birds, foxes and raccoons, lots of creatures have this abundant source of protein that they can feed on. Birds might be able to fledge more young, or mammals raise, you know, an extra pup or two in a year when there's a cicada emergence, but then for the next 16 years they can't depend on that food source.
How are human activities affecting the cicada populations?
The principal way that the populations get affected is due to habitat destruction. As forest lands are cleared, either for production agriculture or for human housing, shopping centers and roads and such, the food sources for the cicadas are being removed. As woodland areas become smaller, the populations can become more concentrated, but there's not so much area for them to feed on. And as the population numbers dwindle, because the cicadas are relatively easy to catch, they need a certain threshold number of individuals to be able to satiate these omnivores and then still have enough members of the population get through to lay eggs for the next generation.
But I think in New York State, the amount of forested land has dramatically increased and the amount of agricultural land has decreased. So wouldn't that actually improve the possibility of cicada communities to continue?
In principle, it could, but we don't know about their dispersal abilities. If they emerge in an area that's too small, that's not near a contiguous forested area, it's not known how widely they'll disperse to look for other suitable habitat. So even though, you're right, areas like the Adirondacks that were practically denuded at the turn of the last century have come back in and we treasure them now, that's not going to help the cicadas that are growing up around here. They're not going to fly that far to look for more forest. So as the forest areas get fragmented, the populations can wink out. And that's been recorded several times in New York already with isolated populations. In 2001, I went around to look at older county records that a previous Cornell entomologist, Laverne Pacuman, had documented in 1967 and in 1984, the two previous emergences of the brood 7. And in 84, he only found them in three counties, Livingston, Cayuga, and Onondaga. And then in 2001, in Livingston and Cayuga, they were gone. I went to the actual sites that he had recorded them, and there were no cicadas there, no emergence holes, no egg-laying scars or flagged trees. So even though there were a few stands of woods remaining there, they were very small. So those are gone, I think. I found them abundant on the Onondaga Indian Reservation and up Route 81 towards Syracuse. But with the expansion of human housing around Syracuse and moving to the south, it may end up extirpating them from those areas and relegating them to living on the reservation. There's very little development on the Onondaga Indian Reservation. So that may be de facto a protected area for the population in the Finger Lakes, even though that's not the intent.
So will society be worse off if we lose the cicadas?
That's a difficult question. There's relatively little economic value in cicadas. And you know, when these sorts of issues usually come down to a tally sheet of economic value versus economic costs, we don't eat them, although they're a reasonable source of protein. But the value, at least that I put on a species being here, is great. It's spectacular to go out into these emergent sites. It's rare that you really get to see that many individuals of a species synchronized in some part of their life cycle, and it's a wonderful thing to see. I've been in Alaska and watched salmon running up the streams, red with salmon and bears feeding on them. It's spectacular to see. I've seen the monarch butterflies at the overwintering sites in Mexico, and seeing tens of thousands, maybe even hundreds of thousands or millions, certainly in the case of the monarchs, is a wonderful thing. It's an aspect of nature that we should appreciate, and because we can't put a monetary value on an ecological service that they provide or a commercial value that they provide, doesn't mean that we should just look the other way and say, oh, well, the cicadas aren't that important anyway. They're noisy, so we're better off without them. I just don't ascribe to that philosophy.
That was Jenny Whiteman interviewing Cornell Professor of Entomology Cole Gilbert. This week's show was produced by Jesse Lind with help from Nana and Simone Cederstrom. Our theme music is an instrumental version of Circus by Crow Greenspun. For more information, email us at info@ithacaradio.org. I'm your host, Sylvie Ginnenthal. Thanks for listening and tune in next week.